Welcome to another episode of Executive Health and Life. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again. And it's been a while since I've done a live or have done a solo episode. I have just been doing a lot of interviews. And so I figured no time was better than now to get back into the habit and to start doing something a little different that I typically do not do as much. So with that said, a lot of you who either watch or listen on the audio platforms, first and foremost, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. Whenever you do catch this episode and the previous ones, your time is your most valuable asset. You can, and that can go to so many different things. So I do thank you for being a listener or being a viewer, because sometimes I haven't been as consistent with weekly episodes. So thank you for that. Now, and as I said, no matter which platform you use, and a lot of my audience is a very busy individual, typically in a leadership role. So and you're making moves. So I'm aiming to make these solo lives very concise, to the point, very narrow in terms of the topic that I'm going to address. And I intend to make these no longer than 15 to 20 minutes. That is my goal. I do not want to make these that much longer. So I want to jump into today's topic with that in mind, which is going to be centered around lab testing. And it's not just any sort of lab testing here. It's the it's lab testing that is more so ones that are tied to longevity. And this list here could have been much longer, actually. But I wanted to think about the big ones, the big rocks per se. And some of these you might already get on your routine physician visit. And some of these you probably wouldn't. And a lot of times you would have to ask for these to get these. And so, or even in some cases, you might even have to just utilize more like a direct to consumer service to get some of these, depending on insurances and some other red tape that goes on when it comes to lab services. So if you need help with the latter, though, definitely feel free to reach out. I'll have my email address at the end of this episode. It's julian@executivehealth.io. And this is part of the work I do in my general consulting. And I have partnerships pretty much throughout the country to pretty much assist with these types of things, except a few states that are a little more complicated. So as I go about these biomarkers, I'm not going to tell you what to do about each of these. I will tell you, though, that diet, exercise, sleep, those things, of course, are going to play a big role in all of these tests and in general, any lab result. But sometimes you need a little more assistance with that. That can depend on the genetics, that can depend on your current lifestyle and all. That gets a little more nuance involved. And that's something that is, I don't think it's fair to do across a YouTube platform or a Spotify platform or wherever you're listening to this at. And frankly, this is also stuff that's in the one-on-one world that I do. So I will offer some general ranges for these biomarkers. Now, before I go any further, I want to say, though, that the information that is shared here, learned here, is not designed to independently diagnose, prevent, or any condition or any disease. You know, this is all for, as I say, research purposes, informational and educational purposes. Nothing I say here is a diagnosis or any shape or form is a patient relationship. So talk to your doctor, your primary health care provider, seek advice from them. And if you have any additional concerns, definitely reach out to them. So now that this legal talk is over, I want to go ahead and dive into these 11 biomarkers real quick. Now, the first thing here is I'm breaking these down into three big categories. And I broke these down into three big categories because I wanted to bring some order to things. And how I think about these 11 here is you're going to have one, inflammation biomarkers. We're going to have two, blood sugar, insulin resistance biomarkers. And we're going to have three, heart biomarkers. These categories are also foundational. These have their fingerprints involved in every facet of the hallmarks of aging, the rate of that we're going to age, various illnesses, how we're going to perform in and out of the office, and just our overall quality of life. So I thought these were a good way to break these down and to have it in a little more of a digestible format. So the first one I want to start with is going to be inflammation. But actually, before I even go with that, I want to go back here, actually, and I want to talk about inflammation. So when you think about inflammation biomarkers, this is measuring inflammation in your body. This is assessing the risk for effects regarding your immune system, your heart health, and more. All these things are also internally connected as well. None of these things exist in a silo. You've heard me ad nauseum say that the human body is a system that does not need to exist in silos. So when you think about blood sugar and insulin resistance, this is the likelihood to have, or you can say develop, blood sugar dysregularities and insulin resistance now or in the future. A lot of the testing that we have now is able to give you essentially a check engine warning light years in advance of something happening that, hey, the way I'm living right now, if I keep doing what I'm doing, then this is most likely what's going to become my reality. And so another word for dysregularities is diabetes. I use these interchangeably. If I'm on my legal talk, I say dysregularities, but they're essentially the same thing. And finally, there's heart health. These biomarkers shared are going to reveal an overall lipid profile that's going to help detect and assess your cardiovascular health. And that's also going to detect for heart disease down the line. Now, when we talk about aging and we're talking about aging and longevity, all of these biomarkers are connected to metabolic health. And more than 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy. That's hard to believe. Obesity has tripled over the past couple of decades. And metabolic health, much like aging, is multifactorial. It's not caused by one thing. There's multiple variables that play a role here. And so we have food choices, we have exercising, we have sleep. These are the ones that are typically spoken for. But for entrepreneurs, business executives, movers and shakers of the world, stress has to be mentioned as well, because not getting rid of it, because this lifestyle that you have chosen when you're in one of these things, you're not worried, you can't get rid of it. It's part of the job, but you can mitigate it. So reducing your stress, reducing your cortisol levels, this can go a long way in reducing inflammation, reducing insulin resistance, and reducing blood pressure, and so much more. Now, let's go into the first category here, and that's going to be inflammation. And the lab here for inflammation is going to be hsCRP. So this stands for high sensitivity C-reactive protein. So this protein is going to measure your general levels of inflammation inside your body. This test is also one that I would prefer, one that I would recommend more so, because this can detect lower levels of CRP much more accurately than the traditional assays. So these elevated levels of hsCRP, these are associated with systemic inflammation, various health conditions such as cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and of course, diabetes. Now, it's a caveat to keep in mind here that these hsCRP levels can fluctuate. It's a very sensitive tool. And so for more of an accurate cardiovascular risk assessment, a lot of times you might want to take two measurements at least 2 weeks apart to get a more definitive outlook of this actual number. And so the next thing here is you'll see a standard range, and then you'll have an ideal range. Standard range is 0 to 1 milligrams per liter. Ideal range changes in this category for male and female. I have 0 to 0.55 milligram per liter. And then I also have 0 to 1 milligram per liter for females. I also have it in molar as well, that you can see on here as well, depending on which labs you're using and which conversions that you are going to get. So there's a couple others that I use for inflammation, but this is a foundational level. And as I said, the purpose of this whole thing is just to give you the biggest bang for your buck, maybe ones that are not so common, to put these in on your radar. And so the next category I want to move on to is insulin resistance. And this is a key one. So when you hear about insulin resistance, I want you to think of a process where your cells stop being as responsive to insulin as they were before. And you have these higher levels of insulin present. Your cells are storing glucose less efficiently. This is leading to higher blood glucose levels. And in response, your body is having this elevated level of glucose. So now your body releases more insulin, leading to even higher levels of insulin, which then continues to make cells less responsive over time. And the process continually repeats itself. And this is insulin resistance in a nutshell. And a stat with this is, unfortunately, is that the number of people with insulin resistance has nearly doubled in the past 30 years. And the thing interesting about insulin is that, and insulin resistance is that, you might think that someone, just because they're overweight or obese, that this is that's the only way to get it. But it's actually a lot of people where you call the proverbial skinny fat, you know, severely under muscled. Maybe they're skinny, lanky, thin, lanky joints and everything, but they have a little pooch and everything. That's a typical skinny fat archetype right there. And those people are a prime candidate as well for insulin resistance. And it's doubled in nearly 30 years. And the thing with insulin resistance, and even with lab markers in general, is that these things are not fast moving in terms of you directly feel something. You're not going to just wake up one day and say, oh, I'm insulin resistant. You know, these biomarkers are slow moving. These biomarkers often sit dormant for so many years. But these are still setting the stage for various chronic diseases and various ailments that are also going to have us age at a much more rapid pace that's unnecessary. So the four biomarkers in this category are ones that provide a pretty much comprehensive, holistic view of your overall framework of insulin resistance. And then when you combine some of the things from the inflammation side of things and then the heart things, that which we'll get to, you have a really good look at how your body is handling in this particular area. So the first one I want to go to is probably the most common one that you receive at a doctor's office, and that's going to be glucose. And glucose is also called blood glucose. This is where the foods we eat, the drinks we use to fuel our body. Higher levels, of course, means that there's too much sugar in our blood, and if the levels remain elevated in your blood, then this can lead to damaging effects with your proteins, with your cells, your tissues, your blood vessels, and of course, in ultimately resulting in accelerated aging, various chronic diseases, various cardiovascular issues, and even sometimes kidney issues. And this is an area that I definitely know about, because a lot of people on my side, on my family, has been affected in the whole blood sugar arena. And so I have a standard range here that you'll see. A lot of times you'll see 65 to 99 milligrams per deciliter. I think that's extremely too wide of a range, honestly. So the ideal range, I would say, is 75 to about 86. Somewhere off in there is a little more ideal, in my opinion. So the next one I want to go to is fasting insulin. And so this is a hormone, and it's going to help move your blood glucose from the bloodstream into your cells in order to keep that glucose at the right levels. Now, I would say also when it comes to this, that you probably want to assess your C-peptide levels as well when you're going to evaluate your insulin status. And I recommend that to go in conjunction with this, because this may not fully reflect your pancreas production. And so here, standard range 2 to 18.4, that's an extremely large range. Extremely large range. So more of an ideal range is going to be 2 to 5. And that's much more ideal compared to this huge range of 2 to 18.4. And so the next one here is HbA1c. This one is one of my favorites to look at and to assess. This is the amount of blood sugar that's attached to hemoglobin. And of course, this is going to help carry oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body. Higher levels, of course, increases the risk of blood sugar dysregularities. And so HbA1c levels also indicate the percentage of hemoglobin that's becoming glycosylated over time, which is a huge, huge thing in terms of aging and the rate at which we do age. I like this test also because this is giving you a longer-term outlook of how your average blood glucose has been over the past 2 to 3 months. And so standard range here is 0 to 5.7. Ideal range to me, 4.6 to 5.3. And the last one here, and I would say this is probably a bonus one in this category, is HOMA2IR. This stands for Homeostatic Model Assessment of Insulin Resistance. And as I said, this is a bonus one in this category. And if you had just the previous three, you would still be provided with a fantastic outlook into your overall blood sugar functioning. Nevertheless, this HOMA2 is a, or I should start with HOMAIR, which you might see as well. This is a calculation that gives you or indicates your level of insulin sensitivity, and is taken into account by measuring and looking at the relationship between insulin and glucose. So HOMAIR, try saying that 100 times, this may be more informative in actuality than the fasting glucose alone or fasting insulin levels alone. So the updated HOMA2, which I labeled here, these calculations are far better at predicting diabetes progression. So maybe a lot of us are probably not at that, what would you say, the disease stage or the illness stage, right? A lot of people here are heavily focused on preventative and making sure we never get there. And so, but this is nevertheless a very heavy hitting one. Another cool thing is the HOMA2IR has an inverse correlation with serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels. And so vitamin D supplementation can actually and significantly improve insulin resistance in vitamin D deficient individuals. Particularly though, this is the caveat, is a daily dose of vitamin D. Not a one-time large weekly dose. Because sometimes you'll hear people say, hey, I take 50, I use on one day a week, maybe on a Saturday or so. Whereas I would say, let's split that up and let's just do 5 each day. That's more of a daily dose. And also, for those who maybe haven't heard some of the previous episodes where I talked about vitamin D, make sure to use it with K2. So standard range here is 0.5 to 1.75. And the ideal range is 0.75 to 1.25. So now we are in our last category, which is our heart health. And these are 6 foundational ones. And some of these definitely you're familiar with and you'll see on your foundational report. And others probably you will not see unless you ask. And so let's go here. The first one is a popular one. We've all heard of this. This is total cholesterol. And pardon me for the typo here. I did not update that on this total cholesterol. So that's still looking at A1C. So, but anyway, cholesterol is an important compound for creating our cell membranes, our steroid hormones, our vitamin D, our bile acids, and even protecting the myelin sheath around our nerve cells. And, you know, cholesterol is a waxy, it's a fat-like substance. It's found in all of our cells. And so higher cholesterol levels are, of course, associated with a plaque production in our arteries, which then, of course, is going to lead to an increased risk of cardiovascular issues. So our standard range that you'll most likely see, you'll see 125 to 200 milligrams per deciliter. The more ideal range is probably hovering in the 160 to 199 is typically what I've seen from just some of the research, the sources, talking to peers, and those types of things. And so the next one here is HDL cholesterol. And this stands for high density lipoprotein. Many people refer to this as the quote unquote good cholesterol, mainly due to HDL picking up excess cholesterol in the body and carrying it to your liver for removal. Now, it's primarily beneficial, but it can become harmful if modified by inflammation or various immune responses. And so there's one last caveat that I want to mention here is that the level of HDL can indicate cardiovascular risk. The functionality of the HDL molecule also plays a significant role in its cardioprotective benefits. So a standard range that you'll most likely see is 46 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. And an ideal range is more in the range of that 55 to 93 range. So almost pretty much similar in this category. And the next one is LDL cholesterol. And when people think of LDL cholesterol, they say this is the quote-unquote bad cholesterol. But these lipoproteins carry leftover cholesterol. After our triglycerides are cleaved from the very low density lipoproteins, you'll see these as VLDLs. These high levels aren't ideal because they're associated with cholesterol plaques, atherosclerosis, and heart disease. And so when it comes to higher than ideal values, diet, exercise, lack of activity, or I'm sorry, diet, excessive weight, I should say, lack of activity, smoking, alcohol consumption, and even certain medications and genetics are all going to play a role with this. So a lot of times with health, and especially with labs and different biomarkers, there's a lot of variance and nuance that has to be considered before looking at these things with a black and white picture and just saying, oh, this thing's out of range, so everything must be bad. Well, not necessarily. This is where you think about this as a system and looking at everything and then going from there. So standard is 1 to 100. Ideal here is more in the 80 to 99.99 milligram per deciliter range. So let's go to triglycerides here, and this is number 9. These are the most common types of fat inside our bodies. They come from butter, oils, and other fats. And they also come from excess calories, in which your body then is going to convert these into triglycerides, then store these in our fat cells. So when our bodies need energy, it releases these stored triglycerides. Higher than normal levels may elevate your risk for atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis is hardening of your arteries, thickening of these artery walls, and also increasing the risk for heart attack, stroke, and heart disease. So basically, pretty much any type of cardiovascular ailment, these are going to play a part in affecting that. And so you'll see a standard range of 0 to 150 milligrams per deciliter, whereas the more ideal range, and it's a more finely tuned range, is to 70 to 80 milligrams per deciliter. But once again, as I've mentioned earlier, and I'll say it 100 times, that there's a lot of variance and there's a lot of nuance, and genetics also has to be factored here. So if one thing's out of range, it doesn't necessarily mean the entire picture is bad. And the next one here is ApoB. And ApoB is a protein that's going to provide a good approximation of the number of atherogenic lipoproteins in your blood. And that word may sound fancy, but all it is just, these are plaque forming. That's all. And ApoB is a primary protein component of the LDL and the VLDL. So beyond just looking at our LDL, looking at our HDL biomarker measurements, this ApoB gives you it helps you go under the hood of the car just in a little more detail, because it's showing you the number of actual, quote unquote, again, bad cholesterol molecules that's in your bloodstream. And so a standard range, 52 to 80, ideal 52 to 80. So pretty much there's a universal agreement between what you would say is mainstream recommendations and more the functional health optimization longevity world recommendation when it comes to these lab numbers. And so the last one here is a huge one, absolutely huge one. And this is LPA. And this is one of the most significant biomarkers for heart disease. And also, this is one that is not going to be on your basic lab reports. You probably have to ask for it. LPA is a unique molecule that's produced by our liver. And the thing that sets LPA apart is it has this addition of the ApoA molecule or lipoprotein. And so our body is going to try to clean as much as this LDL from our bodies. It's trying to get this out of our body as much as possible. But with the addition of this protein here, this is going to help this molecule now to act like a mask. It's going to help disguise this LPA from our cells. So now, as our body is trying to get rid of this, it's harder to get this out of our bloodstream because it has a mask on. So moving on with this story, now you're going to have something that is sticking around longer in our blood. It's getting into various blood vessel walls and, you know, speaking, and you have all this fat and cholesterol that it's carrying around. So it's sticking around in our bloodstream, often leading to plaque formation. You know, worst case scenario down the line, now you're thinking of atherosclerosis. Now you're leading to ailments such as coronary artery disease. These are, once again, worst case scenarios. And so to sum all that up in a sentence, LPA makes it easier for plaque to form, and then it also makes it easier, or I should say harder, for the blood to flow. So more plaque, harder for blood to flow. So think it is like a highway system, and that's why I have the picture there. The more congested it gets with plaques and everything, the harder it is for that blood to flow and everything, and then that's how you get those problems that you hear about. And so I simply just easily think of this as a highway system. And we want to keep the highway system, I would say, as clean as possible, allowing us to freely roam. And not like the, I just came back from a trip from Atlanta. And so not like the Atlanta highway system, which is absolutely asinine and horrible for most of the day. No offense to people in Atlanta. It's a nice place, but the traffic's crazy there on the highway. So I want to go also more LPA talk here because it's a very important one. And so these levels are also predominantly due to genetic risk. And so a published in the 2016 Journal of the Clinical Diabetes and Endocrinology, the LPA gene is increasing the risk of heart disease by more than 50%. And so from what I've gathered there, and I should say this is a gene polymorphism, right? So not everyone's going to have these. And so from what I've gathered from various sources and listening to some people on this is that you don't have to get screened for this each and every time you go to the doctor's office or you get some type of, you order some type of lab work, even at home. But if you do have elevated levels, it is very good to monitor and it is definitely good to work with a physician or someone who is well versed in this. And one of the last things I also put here with this one in particular, because it's a little confusing in terms of when we get to the standard ranges and the ideal ranges, is that the, since it's such a unique structure, the measurement techniques that are used for LPA can also, or I should say, is going to influence these unit conversions. You know, these assays that measure in mass, which is milligrams per deciliter, do not take into account the number of LPA particles, whereas molar-based measurements, nanomoles per liter, do. So therefore, I share the molar-based measurements on here instead. So a universal conversion factor may inaccurately represent some of these concentrations, especially for individuals who have smaller or even larger than average LPA particles. So if you do get tested and you have to convert, just make sure to precisely go about this. And ideal range is 0 to 18 instead of the 0 to 75, which is the standard. So to quickly sum this up here, I'll go over the 11 markers again. And so we have number one is hsCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein. We have glucose, we have insulin, we have HbA1c. We have homeostatic model assessment of insulin resistance. It's a super long word. You can just say HOMA2R. Total cholesterol, HDL, LDL, cholesterol, triglycerides, ApoB, and LPA. So I went a little longer than I expected. I aimed for 15 to 20 minutes. So this will give me a good baseline for when I do these more frequently in terms of the amount of material that I can cover, because I wanted these just to be short and to the point. So this is almost 30 minutes. So, but anyway, any questions, reach me at julian@executivehealth.io. And any other information, other resources, you can just go to executivehealth.io. And other than that, whenever you're receiving this or if you're listening to this on the go on one of the audio platforms, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be CEO of your health and your life. Peace.